Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
There's gold fever on the streets of St. Paul.
$1 billion con.
We finally hit the big time.
A jackpot.
There was no sign of anything that was amiss.
Everybody wanted to get rich.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's too good to be true. It's too good to be true.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Namaste. I'm Devina Gupta. And on this edition... we're talking about American college football and how players there are set to get the due from this multi-billion dollar industry. Also, Boeing's space travel bid and why residents in Texas are unhappy this summer.
I haven't turned my electricity below 74 degrees in years because I can't afford to pay the bill. I just take all the covers off.
All that coming up, so stay with me. But first, this.
Health is not about what weight we lose. It's about all the things a body can gain.
Well, that's an advert from US drug maker Eli Lilly, and you may know it better for its weight loss and diabetes medications, which are so popular that there's a shortfall of these shots in many markets. And so now the company is investing over $5 billion into a new manufacturing site in the state of Indiana in the United States. For more, let's go to Oliver Barnes. He's U.S. pharmaceutical and biotech correspondent at the Financial Times and has been following this story. Oliver, thank you for joining us. Just to the start of it, tell us about why Eli Lilly, these two medications have become so popular. Why is there a shortfall?
Well, simply put, and thanks for having me, simply put, there's a lot of people in the US and across the world with diabetes and with obesity. And these treatments that have come on the market, I mean, the Lilly weight loss drug just came on the market last year, was approved by the US Food and Drug Administration. There's a huge potential addressable market of tens of millions of diabetics and obese people across America. And consequently, Lilly just can't ramp up demand supply quick enough to meet that absolutely massive demand.
This fresh investment in the state of Indiana, what is it going to be used for?
It's going to be used to make the active pharmaceutical ingredients that underpin these two drugs that go by two different brand names, Mounjaro, which is the diabetes brand name, and Zepbound, which is the obesity brand name. It's basically the active chemicals in the drugs. Lilly had already put $3.7 billion to work on building out this 600-acre manufacturing site not far from its headquarters in Indianapolis. But earlier today, it effectively more than doubled that. I mean, it's put $5.3 billion more to work. It will create 900 jobs in the local area. But the most important thing we'll do for Lilly is enable them to ramp up that manufacturing and meet that huge demand that's out there for these drugs.
And also diversify its supply chain.
Well, in part diversify its supply chain. It already has quite a diversified supply chain. It's been investing in manufacturing facilities across the US and Europe. It uses both in-house production and also contract manufacturers. But, you know, this is clearly such a significant kind of investment. It's the type that's been met with praise by the Department of Health and Human Services, the U.S. Health Secretary, couching it within the context of President Biden's efforts to revivify American manufacturing, and also by the Indiana state governor. So there's no way of understating it. Like, this is a very...
ahead of the elections, one must point it out. But looking at what it means for the state, we thought let's go and speak to the locals there. So Oliver, stay with me, because we got some viewpoints of how people there are looking at this investment. Aaron Wren is a columnist for Governing Magazine from Indiana.
Yeah, so this is in the metropolitan Indianapolis region. It's located on essentially the northwestern exurbs, if you will, sort of on the fringe in a town near called Lebanon. And so there's a lot of life sciences companies that are here in a diverse number of sectors. It's also big in the distribution business. And we also, of course, have a lot of manufacturing. Indiana is the most manufacturing intensive state in the United States. So it's a diversified economy, but this type of investment is right in the wheelhouse of what we do here.
And what sort of impact do you think this will bring for the local population and to create jobs in the area?
It's very important. This is going to have about 900 jobs, but this is high-tech advanced manufacturing. So it's good to have corporate headquarters type employees. It's good to have, you know, the scientific researchers, but we also want to have the manufacturing as well so that we have a full economy in our state and we aren't unbalanced. And this is going to be very high paying jobs. This is very high tech manufacturing. And so in terms of keeping those advanced manufacturing jobs in the state, very important. And of course, when your local company decides to continue doubling down on investment, that always makes you feel good.
So that's Aaron Wren, who's a columnist from Indiana. But Keith Mendrick is partner at Amundsen Davids Finance and Real Estate Council and has been following property prices as a result of this investment.
What has come to light recently is that the Indiana Economic Development Corporation has been quietly snatching up land and making side deals with farmers over the course of the past few years to bring this LEAP district to fruition. And there are obviously some concerns about whether enough water is going to be in the area. And I think that there are some intelligent leaders looking to solve that problem, and it can be solved. Really, the bigger concern will be whether the state and companies like Lilly can acquire the land they need. And I think they've made a huge amount of progress before anyone really knew what was going on.
By how much, roughly, do you think the real estate prices have gone up because of the investment by Eli Lilly?
Oh, we've seen easily a doubling.
Does it make land unaffordable for those who are living there?
A bigger issue for those who already have their land and who are farming it or who already own homes in the area is that the tax assessments have been going up. Their property that maybe was worth $500,000 is now worth $1 million, and their taxes are doubling or more to go along with that. That is where the rubber really meets the road and makes affordability a concern for people who were already in the area.
So that's Keith Mundrick from the property sector there. So different viewpoints over here, Oliver, about this investment. But I want to bring in a third angle, and that's also what's being debated globally with not only Eli Lilly, but its competitor, the Danish company, which is Novo Nordisk. When these companies are expanding and there's sort of a race to the top, the ethics of business have been questioned by many, because as these companies expand, so does the debate around the lifestyle choices that they offer. Often there is allegation of misuse of these drugs as well.
Yeah, so Lilly and Novo have made a big point of trying to kind of launch a kind of public health campaign against the misuse of these drugs, saying that they should only be used for the indications they've been approved for, which is type 2 diabetics and people who are kind of severely overweight. But clearly, the reason most of your listeners will know about them is the hype that Ozempic's had in Hollywood and amongst, you know, celebrities. And the companies are kind of making efforts effectively to cleave those things apart and change the reputation of those. But the other element that it's important for the companies is trying to educate people and change the perspectives on obesity, right? Because at the moment, there's a wide-scale perception that obesity is driven by people's individual decisions. And for the companies to get the U.S. government and, you know, and the Center for Medicaid Services to pay for these drugs and cover them, and for insurers in the U.S. to cover them, they need to convince people that actually obesity is as much of a disease.
But then, Oliver, just briefly then, perhaps just 30 seconds that we have on this one, but does this also mean that price points of some drugs, which especially, as you've mentioned, obesity drugs also will go down?
Well, this is something that Senator Sanders, Bernie Sanders, for instance, has taken issue with these firms about the list price of both Ozempic, Novo Nordisk compound, and also Lilly's is around $1,000 per month. The prices will come down, but that's largely because of legislation that President Biden has brought in, which is at some point they'll be negotiated and pulled down by the U.S. government and the Center for Medicaid Services. But that's probably like a few years away. And they are also considerably cheaper in single-payer systems like the U.K. and across Europe.
Thank you so much, Oliver Barnes, their correspondent with Financial Times. Appreciate your time. Now, let's move to something which is more off the field, but on the field, I'll tell you why. Now, first, the on the field part. You would think that this is from a professional football match, but actually that's a playoff between two college teams in the U.S., Football, along with many other college sports, have been a multi-billion dollar industry, attracting huge audiences, sponsors, media, you name it. And that's where off the field part comes, because surprisingly, the college athletes there who are playing the game are not directly paid. So all this is about to change. The National Collegiate of Athletic Association, which governs university sports in the US, has reached a deal that could lead to these college athletes finally getting their dues being paid. I spoke earlier with Ben Portney, who is a journalist who covers college sports for the Sports Business Journal.
So when we're talking about the money behind college sports and where it comes from, the biggest piece of it is television networks. In the United States, there's huge viewership numbers for football in particular. And I think that it has kind of become the backbone for this. It's networks like ESPN and Fox and NBC and others shelling out, you know, frankly, billions of dollars each year for the media rights to college athletics. And I think that is where the difference is, I think, for the United States versus other countries and the size of college sports. Because the reality is over 150 years, college sports have changed a lot, but they started out as sort of, you know, what you would expect, right? Schools having teams that compete against each other, and they've grown into this enormous juggernaut with financial backing, like I said, through sponsorship, obviously, is some of it, but also the key component here again is these broadcast media rights deals from networks that kind of finance the whole operation at the moment.
And it's interesting to see that from this money, the coaches are paid, trainers are paid, but the athletes weren't paid up till now.
Correct. And I think that's the interesting thing that, and I think is frankly some of the hypocrisy I think that's gone existed with the NCAA and college sports in the United States for a long time. And a lot of folks have said is that, you take this in any context outside of college athletics in the United States and say, hey, we're going to have a business where we have, you know, make all this money, but we're not going to pay the people who actually do the work. And it doesn't really make any sense. It doesn't really hold any water.
But weren't they saying that this is a way for students to earn their scholarship, essentially go through college just by playing football?
Exactly. And I think that was the sort of longstanding argument was, hey, because you're part of this system, because you're part of this ecosystem, you get a scholarship, you get access to a university, all of the things that come with that. And certainly there's other perks of the trade and being a part of a team and all of that. But that was kind of the longstanding argument was basically that your compensation was your scholarship. And I think that has obviously changed as the price tags have changed immensely.
So what's the framework that's been agreed now?
Yeah, so the framework has a couple of different pieces. Like I said, there's kind of three pieces to it. There's back pay that's going to look at athletes basically dating back to 2016 who weren't able to make money off of their what's kind of being referenced as name, image, and likeness. So that be able to be sponsored by companies and things like that and create marketing deals and things like that. That's going to be up to, you know, $2.8 billion. The other part of this is sort of policing of some of those things and some changes to the scholarship numbers. That's another piece of this. And then the big number that I think stands out the most is the future revenue sharing. So as I mentioned, obviously these media rights deals that are in place in the United States are huge numbers, right? And over the next 10 years, they're kind of projecting that roughly $20 billion could be paid out to athletes over the course of the life of this deal, basically.
So for a student, do we know an estimated pay package?
We don't. And I think that's the piece that's still to be worked out. I think, again, it's going to vary a lot by the school. It's going to vary, vary a lot by the sport, by the team.
But what's the impact that you then see on college sports?
For one, schools have to find a way to pay for this. And I think that's a huge issue right now, is that schools are basically going to have to shake the couch cushions to find, you know, $20 million. And again, that's a lot easier said than done.
That was journalist Ben Portnoy. So that angle that he was talking about, what does it mean for athletes? Let's go across to Matt Hand, who runs a sports management agency called Name, Image and Likeness Agency, Alta Sports Management. Thanks so much, Matt, for being with me. So right up your alley then, what does this mean for college athletes going on from here, especially in terms of pay package? What can they expect?
Yeah, so I think in terms of the pay package, I think as Ben mentioned, we're not exactly sure how it's going to play out. There are a lot of different legal hoops that still need to be jumped through in terms of how it's going to be allocated, if it's going to be allocated based on revenue share or the actual Title IX statutes in the United States, which require equal opportunity for men and women. And in addition, for just student athletes as a whole, I think one of the big things we're going to see is the push towards employment status for the student athletes, which will allow them to unionize, will allow them to have collective bargaining with the NCAA, and in turn take a bigger share of the pie, which many of them believe they are entitled to.
So going ahead for their professional careers, does it mean that earlier when they would go fresh in the market, students could now have more bargaining power with the kind of franchise they want to join?
I don't believe so. The way it's set up right now, it's going to stay roughly the same. This is more so for student athletes to be able to make money while they're in college. Professionally, I don't think we're going to see much of a change on that front.
And you've been speaking to student athletes. I'm sure you interact with them. It is a good news, but what could be the challenges for them? Because especially with colleges with lower budgets, for example, will it be hard for them to go there?
I think so, in a sense of competition wise. Of course, all of the top schools with the most money are going to have more money to allocate to their student athletes. This would in turn create an effect where a lot of the student athletes who are at the larger schools may have matches or games against students from the less popular schools, the schools with less money, which would kind of ruin the competitive nature for a lot of these universities. Again, I think overall, there's still going to be good competition with the top schools. But with the bottom schools and the students there, it's going to be harder for them to be making as much money as the students who go to a bigger brand name school.
Well, Matt, just got about 45 seconds or so. But when it comes to female athletes as well, do we see equal terms of deals? Or like we see in the sports industry, that there is a big gender pay gap in many sports that we see here also?
Yeah, so there is a big gender pay gap in sports right now, but the United States does have Title IX, which I mentioned earlier, yeah, which is a federal statute which requires payment be equal for men and women. Obviously, right now, the way that they're going to allocate the funds is not known, but I would not be surprised to see any legal challenges if the female student athletes were not paid the same as the male counterparts. So that'll be something to watch.
Matt Hand, thank you so much for joining us, running sports management consultancy there. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service.
Press freedom. The reasons why it's under increasing pressure.
How the mass use of drones has changed the way the war is being fought.
The trends behind the fast-changing media landscape.
The Explanation from the BBC World Service takes a deep dive into the big stories affecting our lives, giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, I've just come back from India, which is sizzling hot at 47 degrees. and energy bills there are shooting up in many homes which switch air conditioning during this season. And I often wondered how people in other parts of the world deal with such a situation, especially those living in high-income economies like the US. Are they also worried about their energy bills? And do they have enough power capacity during the season? So Elizabeth Trowell from our US partner Marketplace was in Texas in the US to find out just that.
At a Cracker Barrel southeast of Houston, I catch up with Robin Wright. Yes, like the actress.
Except she has way more money.
Wright works here in another restaurant 6 days a week to support her and her 12-year-old granddaughter. She makes her money stretch, and that means this summer being careful not to crank up the AC.
I haven't turned my electricity below 74 degrees in years because I can't afford to pay the bill. I just take all the covers off.
But I really would rather it be really cold and snuggle under the covers.
Wright knows how to adapt to extreme weather. She lost power for a week during the 2021 Texas freeze and evacuated her home for nearly a month after Harvey.
So we adapt by wearing almost nothing inside the house, and that's all we can do.
In 2022, Texans paid twice as much for electricity compared to pre-pandemic prices, according to the Dallas Fed. And prices have stayed volatile. Ed Herz, who teaches energy economics at the University of Houston, says that volatility has to do with how power plants in Texas get paid.
Only when those power plants are putting electricity into the grid is the only time they make money.
And he says plants actually make more money when electricity is tight. Other grids are more cautious. They pay for capacity, meaning how much energy they might possibly use. There's more of a cushion if there's a cold snap or heat wave. Hers compares it to paying for the fire department.
Nobody likes paying for extra capacity, but think about it. We don't use fire departments all day long, and we pay to keep them around.
But Texas takes a deregulated approach. That means when there's sudden demand for extra electricity, prices go up 10, 20, 60 fold. That's bad for consumers during extreme weather. But in the past, this leaner approach has meant cheaper bills. Energy consultant Doug Lewin.
Texas did experience very low prices for quite a while.
But when the catastrophic freeze of 2021 knocked out electricity across the state, it was a wake-up call. Now, more money is being spent on capacity to give more of an energy cushion. But it's ad hoc. The deregulated structure of the Texas energy market is the same.
That sort of leads to the worst of both worlds, frankly.
Lewin isn't convinced the grid is actually more reliable, and
which you definitely end up with is higher prices.
So what is Texas to do when the weather is getting hotter and more people are moving in? Some people say the state needs to build more natural gas power plants to come online when demand spikes. Lewin says Texas needs to address energy demand, like improving energy efficiency.
That needs to be brought into the market, both for reliability, because high demand is one of the biggest risk factors in whether or not we're going to have blackouts, and to help lower bills.
Bills that will continue to weigh on low-income Texans this summer. There are programs that can help. One is run by the nonprofit Baker Ripley in Houston. Desiree Davis runs the utility assistance program.
The need for the program, the assistance far outweighs the amount of funds that we have.
Some requests for aid come after power has already been shut off. Last summer, Baker Ripley helped 34 households get their lights back on. In hot summer months, Davis says electric bills can increase 25 to 50%. It can be especially tough for those on a fixed income.
When I was a customer service representative, was a senior that I still work with to this day, that she literally was considering taking her own life. Because she was struggling to pay her energy bill.
She says many have to choose between keeping the power on or paying for their meds or food.
It's a tough choice there. Elizabeth Trouble from Marketplace. Now, in the past couple of hours, there's a big announcement that's been made by Boeing and NASA. It's a green light for the much-awaited Starliner capsule, which will carry astronauts to the space. The mission has been delayed several times already. Just a week ago, the team reported a small helium leak in the service module of the spacecraft. But now the agency said tests have found that the leak does not pose a threat to the flight. So it's all set to go off on the 1st of June. Joining me now is former advisor to NASA on astrophysics and planetary science, Laura Forsick. Thanks, Laura, for being with us. So if this mission is successful, it'll be the second private firm able to provide crew transport for NASA. It's a, as they say, a small step, an expensive one at that from a company, but a giant leap for space commerce here.
That's correct. We've been waiting for this for years. They are years behind schedule, but it will be a big milestone if they can successfully complete this mission.
Now, it's been a decade in the making, as you said, it's been years, and billions of dollars have been spent on it. Just tell us, what will happen after this? How does it change the idea of space travel?
Boeing is contracted to carry NASA astronauts as well as partners, and those partners can include Europeans, it can include Japanese, and it can include Russians to the International Space Station. Now, the big question is, aside from government contracts, is there a market for commercial customers for Boeing? And we just don't see, at least I personally don't see, how Boeing can compete with SpaceX, because SpaceX has been flying these contracts for 4 years now, and SpaceX is flying additional contracts with humans on private missions. So they are just yards away from Boeing. You know, Boeing has a lot to catch up on.
So SpaceX has been flying Dragon capsule for NASA since 2020, but it also shows how NASA no longer wants to own and operate such vehicles and its partnership with private players.
That's correct. So NASA retired the space shuttle program in 2011. And ever since then, they've been relying on commercial vehicles to fly not just crew, but also cargo to the International Space Station. And they're taking that same mentality to the moon, where they're also contracting with companies like Boeing, SpaceX, Blue Origin, to bring cargo and astronauts to the surface of the moon and to a space station called Gateway.
And how do you see this private player's race to space then?
It's exciting. So much potential here with commercial space stations that are going to be coming on board after the International Space Station retires. So there's a number of commercial space stations that will need transportation. And so Boeing, SpaceX, and others like Sierra Space could provide that transportation for the cargo, and the crew. The crew could be government payloads or government astronauts, or they could be commercial customers as well, private individuals like you and me.
Really? Well, I don't know if I have billions yet, but hopefully when it's affordable with this competition, why not? Laura Forsick, thank you so much for joining us. Former advisor to NASA, you've been listening to World Business Report. Namaste.
Press freedom. The reasons why it's under increasing pressure.
How the mass use of drones has changed the way the war is being fought.
The trends behind the fast-changing media landscape.
The explanation from the BBC World Service takes a deep dive into the big stories affecting our lives, giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.